Welcome to part two of our conversation with David Pierce Rodriguez about growing out of possession. Would you say, was there any sort of intervention that occurred in your case that helped relieve you of the possession, as one would think of, you know, exorcisms and things of that nature? Or was it really simply just the move that lifted this away from you?
It was the move. It was a change of school. It was, I was going to a new high school. I had been going to a male-only high school before, and then I get to go to a one with women and men. I'm finally 16. You know, I moved with my dad. It was a great time. My whole mind shifted, and I don't think that – I mean, that's probably the most important thing in a possession case, is changing the mindset of the person, of the host, you know, mm-hmm. the one who has the possession, because like a fish who lives in salt water can't live in the fresh water. It's the same thing. You change the alkalinity and you change the vibe, and they don't want to live with you anymore. Mm-hmm. And also that the location, I think that thing was tied more to Ohio and that stuff. I mean, even just with paranormal cases in general, some of the stuff will stick with you. I don't think the ghost necessarily comes home with you unless you have an object or something, but you can bring kind of like some, you know, mojo from a case. I've had it multiple times. And I think the thing from going through a possession like that, that stuff sticks with you for a while. But it couldn't live with me once I moved. I just was a different person altogether. Mm-hmm. But if I would have lived in Columbus and not left, I would have had to have some kind of intervention. I was going to church at the time. I probably would have done something, asked them about it. I mean, it was Methodist, so I don't know if they would have helped. But it just... I did ask a lot of questions at church back then, but mm-hmm. wasn't really getting the answers that I wanted. But, yeah.
When you look back at that house and the darkness that seemed to surround it as an adult all these years later, and I know you say you're still drawn to it, but you can't go in there. Someone else is living there. What have you found? When you look back, do you have any idea, any research, any information on what was causing such darkness on that property, such a oppressive type force that obviously affected you greatly, but also did affect the others who resided there as well?
Yeah, there was like a lot of there was deaths on our family there. There was a lot of strange deaths in that house too, like people falling downstairs and things like that, dying that way. And it just, the house is real. It's a creepy place in a way. It's awesome, beautiful house, but it's like, it's got that at nighttime, that place shifts. Like I said, it's got little like mazes, like trap doors, and, mm-hmm. and it's got like a dumb waiter that goes from the top floor to the bottom floor. Really strange things. Where like a kid can hide out and go down the dumb waiter. Sorry, Tony, I totally forgot what you're asking.
Now, so my question is, what's behind the darkness of that house? Do you have any idea why it would be so haunted?
It would have to do with, I think it's the land, the property, and probably my grandfather helped build that house. It was built out of limestone rock from a quarry. Mm-hmm. Maybe that had something to do with it. I think the creek that would go around the back of the house had a lot to do with it. The land that it was by, a Native American burial ground, had something to do with it. Probably the limestone had the main thing to do with it. I've noticed, like, if you have weird shaped houses with strange corridors and stuff, those houses tend to get, can I say, more haunted maybe than other houses do? Like, I mean, look [S2] Sure. [S1] At the Winchester house and stuff like that. Just, I don't know why. Maybe that traps a ghost into a, if they're going around a weird angle or something. I don't know. But that house is, it just was haunted. I mean, you could have, I mean, anything could be haunted, but that mm-hmm. house was just, it's the property.
So you look more so back on like the geographics and the architecture and all of that as kind of being almost a perfect storm for attracting negative energy into it, not necessarily a single traumatic event or a series of traumatic events that had occurred on the property or something like that that you were unaware of.
Yeah, maybe it does hold, it holds all those deaths, and it held the rape of that girl, and it holds, that property is just, it keeps it like a memory.
It just kind of keeps going and going. Yeah. We can go to the Energizer Bunny line there. Tell me more about now, as you did get older, obviously, you know, you had moved on into your teen years and later finding interest still in the paranormal, but not really being able to pursue it in your 20s. What were some of the small things that were happening that slowly kind of drew you back into that world of, hey, I'm going to take a second shot at investigating the paranormal, and hopefully this time I won't get possessed?
Well, it started happening when I started working as a restaurant manager, you know, in college, you know, bartending, waiting tables, and then it took on to, went up to, managing restaurants. And there was a restaurant called Il Radicchio in Arlington, Virginia, and I was a manager there. It's still there, a little Italian restaurant, two-level place, and the place is just absolutely super haunted. I went there earlier this year and talked to the manager too, and was asking him about the stories and like, oh yeah, we heard about you with the ghost and all this. But when I'd manage there at night, the strangest thing would happen. Like there was a girl that worked there that every time she was working, we had one of those big like CD players that had like, it would spin like 20 discs, you know, it was like the biggest one you could get and would shuffle them all the time. So we usually put Italian music in there and some other stuff. And then, so everyone would leave, the music's still playing. And as she's about ready to clean up and everything, pretty much every time she was working, it would go to this one song. And I'm like, I started noticing after four or five times, I'm like, her name was Terrier. And I said, Terrier, why is it, what is this song? And why is it when you're working that the song comes out? She goes, oh, it's my favorite song. And I go, does this always happen? She goes, yeah, it's been happening since I started working here. And I go, don't you think that's like crazy or what? And she's odd. Like, oh yeah, this place is super haunted. She goes, I won't even go upstairs to get, like, you know, where the office was. She goes, I won't go up there to get anything. Sometimes you had to get plates and things up there, and they'd make the pizza dough upstairs. And she goes, I won't go up there at night. She goes, it's super haunted. And whatever it is, I think it's a man, and he's like attracted to me, and, you know, and that's why he's playing the music. But so that story would happen. And then one night I'm there by myself. Right next to the office is a bathroom. So I have to do the paperwork at night, count the money. I have the downstairs absolutely locked, and downstairs was just the chef cleaning up there. But I have to lock the door because, you know, I'm counting thousands of dollars, and it's DC, and, you know, anybody can come rob you. So I have all my paperwork set up, money on the desk. I go to pee really quick. I go like right there, and I hear the trash can. I mean, I could tell what the sound was. It was the trash can went across the floor and then up to my chair, and it was the trash can that was up in the corner. And I would kind of like, you know, crumple the paper up and basketball it over, you know, to try to make that. That's how, that was the thing we would do. All the managers just throw it in there, so you just see crumpled paper, you know, balls all around the floor where people would miss. And I hear that thing go across the floor. I'm like, what? I run out and it's right up against the chair. And I go, this is crazy. I said, I have to start filming this, or this is, you know, people need to see this. This is like, that's crazy. You know what I mean? A trash can just moved across the floor. So then that got me interested into it. It wasn't too much later. Well, I had to move from DC. I was married at the time to somebody who was in the military, so in the Navy. So we got, sent up to Omaha, Nebraska. And then once we got to Omaha, Nebraska, things were slower there, not much to do. So I started my team. I mean, I tried to join a team first. There was only a team there that was a couple, like a man and a woman, and they didn't want anybody to join them. So I started like a meetup.com thing, and people came, and we ended up starting a team, and that was that.
I see. When you began investigating the paranormal with this new team that you had created initially, what was going through your mind is what were you trying to accomplish? Obviously, everybody, you know, interest in getting evidence and things of that nature. But overall, was it just to collect evidence and you know, prove that it exists to one another?
Yeah, I think with it was curiosity? Proving.
Okay.
Yeah, it was proving. You know, I was still, I guess, taking on that the weight of when I was a kid, and I wanted to, you know, prove that trash can going across the floor, prove that this stuff existed. And, you know, I mean, I'd never been in a paranormal team, and never even, you know, it was nice to have that camaraderie. Everyone had the same kind of goal. Everyone had cameras, and everyone was buying EMF detectors, and, you know, cassette recorders or whatever the heck we were using 20 years ago. And it was a lot of fun. And it's, you know, now when people say, why do you investigate? I guess every case is different, you know, I mean, some cases, you know, but back then it was just to kind of, I was just happy to go to a cemetery, to tell you the truth. I didn't know that it would end up the Villisca Axe murder house and craziness like that.
Did you, or should I ask, how soon into investigating with your team at the time, that new team that you had formed, did you get your proof that you were seeking?
It was really, really fast. Within the first year, I think by Christmas of 2014, we were already on TV, like with the local news. So I learned really early on that if I wanted to get in somewhere, like having the news come with you is a really good way to get in somewhere. So I kind of, I went out looking for, to kind of, I don't know, prove, disprove, or find the places that were on, you know, any, back then, what was it, where there was like a list of haunted places, but that's where everyone would work off the internet. There's like this one list. And I would go there and see anything that was around my area. And I'd be like, oh, that's good, that's not. Then I started to kind of prospect other places. But we did like the Squirrel Cage Jail. We were the first people to go in there. And literally within the first year, got an apparition photo of the thing. We got great EVPs. I don't know, just I had a really good team, that we had really good results. And you know, sometimes you have just the right people and the right time. I mean, everything that first year or two of PRISM in Nebraska just was amazing. We went so many places and got so much stuff. I mean, we were in the first year, we were at the Villisca Axe murder house, one of the first people there. We I even went there with Troy Taylor, Ursula Bielski. And I was telling Troy, I said, the door opens and closes. It's on its own there. And he goes, no. I said, no, it does. And then Ursula was upstairs, saw it happen to her. And she's like, oh, my God. So he runs up there and sees it for himself. I'm like, this place is truly, truly, truly haunted. I mean, just even just that door. My wife who's a commander in the Navy, my ex-wife. She didn't really believe in all this kind of stuff. She thought it was fun that I was doing it. It was a good hobby for me or whatnot. But when she saw the door open and close in Villisca on its own, she believed after that. So I mean, that house made a lot of people believers. And it was nice to be able to take the news there and go to someplace that was really haunted. So you're actually getting good evidence, you know?
Sure. Did you have any reservations or fear about getting involved in the paranormal world, you know, on a level of investigating again? As a child, you were, you know, doing your version of investigating as a kid at your childhood home. But then you're setting out again here as an adult to subject yourself to the paranormal. And obviously, first round, it didn't work out the greatest with the possession, to put it lightly.
Right.
Were you concerned at all of just having firsthand, having had that experience, was there any caution, you know, in you about going back into that atmosphere of, could this happen again?
Well, I didn't really think that until, I mean, because ghosts to me are a whole different ballgame than like what was going on there. It didn't hit me until we had a possession case in Omaha at this one apartment. And then I started to see the, I mean, there's even a time where the woman who's possessed came up to me, puts me up against the wall. Her eyes are all black underneath. She totally would change. Put me up against the wall and she's like, you're going to go to hell. I've met you already. Like this thing, like, and I'm thinking, and then it hits me in my head. This is the same person that was like, is this the same like demon or whatnot that doesn't know like me, like my story? Because I didn't tell anybody that back then. You know, does it know what I went through? Is it the same, you know? And then you start thinking, oh, crap, this is cyclical, you know, this could affect me. And actually that case, I think, led to my divorce. It was one of the things that did. I mean, obviously I was part of that. My ex-wife was part of that, but it was one of the things that really led to my divorce, taking on that case. It's just, so now, you know, if there's a possession case or something, I feel like I have something to give to these people. So I don't really think twice about it, but I understand that how they can get, you know, how dangerous they can get. I mean, in that case alone, there was people on our team were passing out. They were having fits on the floor, you know. We had a couple of nurses on our team back then, and it's just they get dangerous, those cases.
Sure. And I want to hear about that case. It was going to be my next question, is what led you to get involved with the possession case? How did that come to you? And if you would, you know, kind of walk us through what went down there.
Well, that was back in the day when I kind of leave my card out with a phone number at like New Age shops and whatnot. There was nothing paranormal. Nobody would do anything about that back in the day in Nebraska. So I put that out there and hope somebody would call. And these were the type of people that, like, it's a nightmare. The type of people that will call you at 2 a.m. type of thing.
Sure, yeah.
But, and I'm like, oh my God, I'll never do that again. Put my phone number out. But it ended up just a really interesting case. I mean, I'm glad I experienced it with them, but it was basically these people, this couple, they were in their early 40s, I'd say. They had moved into this apartment that, come to find out later, that a couple weeks before they moved in, or a week before they moved in, there was some kind of crack deal gone bad, and the guy got shot in the apartment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there was a murder in that apartment, literally, like right before they moved in. I'm sure that didn't help anything. And they came in and basically they called me saying, ever since we moved to this apartment, it's affecting our job. It's affecting sleep, that she's waking up with scratches and all this. So I went over there, and immediately when I went to that house, like doing a pre-investigation, I did get that same sense of like when I was a kid, like there's certain things with a possession, at least I believe with a possession, that it tends to, like, I guess originally it's maybe in the house and then it affects the person, but then it affects the house even more. Like in this house, there was even like, it's an oil coming out of some of the walls. Like it was alive, that house, in a sense that, I don't even know how to explain it, but it definitely had the, like, you would walk in and go, oh, something's going on here. You know, even if you didn't believe it, it was a thick atmosphere in that house.
Yeah.
And it would change when she would, I have a video on YouTube about it. If anybody wants to see it, just have to look up Omaha, Nebraska possession prism or something like that. You'll find it. It's a really old video, but, I took one video of her where she was, you know, going into the change. And at this time, basically what would happen is we'd have her sitting in a chair. She would just kind of start rocking. We'd all just be talking. And then the minute she'd start getting quiet, and then her eye, like she would just kind of have like these neck, like kind of like moving her neck around. And then her eyes would kind of look all wacky. And then her voice would change, and we'd see the shift, you know. And I have a nurse there taking her blood pressure at the same time. I just wanted to find out as much as we could. And it's interesting to the nurse. It was interesting to see what would happen in a case like this. But what would happen is I would put, what were we using back in the day? Cause we didn't have REM pods. It was, those cell sensors.
Okay.
Which are now like ghost meter or whatever, but the cell sensor with the cable, I would have a cell sensor in every room. And in her bedroom, in the kitchen, in the living room, in the bathroom, what happened is when she would start turning and going and doing all these weird voices and stuff, and then fighting with her husband would start being like, in the name of Jesus, you know, whatever, because that's how he felt like he needed to deal with it. You know, we're casting you out and stuff, the husband would say. Probably he's been watching too much TV. But I guess that was for the church more to do than him. But he's afraid, so I get that. But what would happen in the house is the meters would – it would go off in the bedroom first. You'd hear beep, 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 beep. And then she'd do like a little laugh. And then you'd hear beep, 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 beep. It'd get higher. And then the kitchen would start going beep, beep, beep. Basically, by the time she was like all full on possession, there's like six meters going off throughout the whole house. The whole house is charged, you know. It's crazy stuff. And you could feel it was going on, you know. And then stuff would happen. Like it would take on like usually the weakest person. They would feel something, like they'd have to get out of that house because it was just, they would either get too much of a headache, want to throw up, or you know, some person went into spasms. It was just crazy stuff. and we ended up working with the church. The church really, it was hard to get help with the church. Got a bunch of evidence, videotaped it, and actually went to different churches looking for help. And one did help us. They said they were going to do a high mass and pray on it. And, you know, they'd get back to me if anything, whatever. And basically the next day they got back to us saying that they would help, that they prayed on it. And yes, the family needed help. So, you know, that was fortunate. But they came, two weeks later, this whatever it was back. They came a second time. It came back. These people had to move. She moved to a different state, and things got a little bit better, but things, you know, kind of followed her around a little bit, but the vibe of it all did. But it got better when she moved. That apartment was just really bad.
Yeah. I mean, when you went into that and to hear that she had eventually, it seemed to have resolved itself, were you concerned with the familiarity of the feelings that maybe this was something similar? Maybe this was the same sort of thing that had possessed you as a child and it was back. Are you ever fearful of when you kind of get into some of those similar circumstances or feelings that maybe something is not that far away from you or that distant and that it could make a return? Is there anything that you do today to protect yourself from that?
Well, I guess the first part of the thing there was that, like, when I was there, like, when she was talking to me, I could feel that it knew about the stuff that I had gone through, but just by the stuff she was saying that she had said to me during days there. But it was not the same creature, being, demon, whatnot. It was just, I think they have, I mean, do they talk to each other? Do what goes on? But, like, they know from case to case they can carry on stuff like a memory, and I don't know what that's all about, but that's for, I'm not a demonologist, but I'm sure they would understand. But the second part of the question there is, what were you asking me? The second part is do I like have an attachment from this stuff? Probably would be the question, right?
That or are you afraid of getting one more so?
Well, I think that some of like the energy of what I went through stuck with me. I don't think that being is with me anymore. I do believe that you can have attachments. I do believe in guardian angels and things like that as well. I mean, I've had stories with that happen as well. But I think things are following. I think we have things following us all the time. Every human being does. I mean, that's just my belief, but sure. Hopefully good stuff and not bad stuff. But, I think when this stuff, like I say, if it depends on the case, if I'm on a case that's really dark, then I can kind of feel maybe that's, I kind of feel that there was, I don't know how to explain it, but God, like that, how do you explain? Boy, I'm a loss for words right now. But like that case, the possession case, I can see remnants. I feel remnants of what was going on in me. But I think it's just more like a place memory from before, saying I've been here before type of thing. I don't, like that stuff doesn't show itself anymore because I just don't think it's around me. But
that wraps up the second part of our conversation with David Pierce Rodriguez. A big thanks to him for joining us on today's program and sharing his very personal experiences with all of us. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. if you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.
Ahora en McDonald's, te puedes llevar un $5 McChicken Meal Deal o un $6 McDouble Meal Deal. Así, hay algo para todos. Llévate más por tu dinero con tu Meal Deal. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Solo por tiempo limitado. Precios y participación pueden variar. Precios con entrega pueden ser más altos.